Good morning, everybody. It's February 26, 2024. I'm Herb Morgan, Senior Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer of Cantor Fitzgerald Managed ETF Portfolios. This is my weekly economic and market commentary. As a reminder, if there's something to be said intra-week, we'll be sure to put it up on either LinkedIn under Herb Morgan or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at ETF underscore strategist. Let's get into it. The presentation you are seeing and or hearing has been prepared by Cantor Fitzgerald Investment Advisors LP for use with both investors and financial advisors. Of course, each are expected to make their own investment decisions. Nothing contained in the presentation should be treated as investment advice. There are no recommendations for the purchase or sale of any securities. We had a positive week in equities with the exception of the small cap stocks, small cap 600 as measured by S&P or the Russell 2000, both negative on the week, while the S&P 500 rose again 1.7%, international markets up about 1.5%, emerging markets were strong. It seems China has had one heck of a run in the month of February, up about 11% last time I checked. Still a long, long way to go, we know, but it has what appears to be some bottoming formation taking place. Interest rates were steadied a little bit lower last week, and fixed income markets caught a little bit of a bid. The aggregate bond index is up 0.25%, and the 20-plus year treasury index, longer-term index, will always be more volatile, up about 1%. Year-to-date, you can see those two fixed income are still down. Interestingly, you know, last year, 2023, we ended up with positive returns at a time when we were hiking rates for the better part of half the year, and there were no rate cuts. And then this year, where there's still expectations of rate cuts, we actually see negative returns on both the Ag 177 and the 20 plus, down almost 5%. So it tells you how difficult it is to try to trade your expectations for things like earnings or rate hikes or the economy. Very, very difficult. Let's get into the economic data last week. There were some important releases. First one was these two flash readings from S&P Global on U.S. manufacturing and U.S. services. We will get the final readings this week, but these flash readings are indicative that the economy continues to accelerate. And you know, one of the themes I've been talking about is a reacceleration. We sort of skipped off the bottom, didn't get the recession so many of us thought was possible last year. Inflation moderated substantially and significantly, but there's now risk of reacceleration both in the economy as a whole and in the inflation, which is going to provide some challenges for the Federal Reserve. You can see here up from 50.7 to 51.5 in manufacturing, 2 months in a row above 50. After many months below 50, which would have signaled contraction, in manufacturing being only 15% of the economy, that contraction was sort of overridden or balanced out by growth in the services sector. The services PMI was still positive all of last year and remains so today. Came in at 51.3, down from 52.5. The estimate was 52.3. Again, we'll get the final reading this week. The other reason we still can't have a recession is jobs remain aplenty. Weekly jobless claims, initial claims for unemployment last week, were at 201,000. The estimate was for 216,000. These numbers are still at levels not seen since the 1960s. When the labor force was about half the size it is today. So it's easy to say, literally, the best jobs market in the history of the data that's collected. So very substantial. Continuing claims down from 1.9 to 1.862. Nothing to see there in particular. We had a little bump up in existing home sales, not as much as expected, but you can see existing home sales have remained low. For a significant period of time, ever since interest rates stopped being zero. There's no surprise to anybody there that when interest rates were zero, existing home sales were going through the roof, prices were appreciating substantially. Now that interest rates are normalized, not excessively high, but normalized interest rates, much harder for homes to turn over. There's also the supply issue and the affordability issue, despite the massive availability of jobs. Now, given this great run-up we've had starting at the beginning of the fall of last year to where we are today, even with good earnings growth and momentum. I think it's reasonable to say that markets may be overbought in the short run. You can see here's October bottoming, S&P 500 down around 4150. I can't see the exact number, but around 4150 or so, and a run up all the way to about 5100 on the S&P 500. Back here, the RSI, or relative strength index, was very low. You know, when you get that sort of sell-off and then a low RSI, from a technical perspective, as a lot of us would say, is tactically, markets could proceed higher. That's exactly what they've done. Back here in late December, we felt the markets had gotten tactically overbought. You can see the danger of trying to trade that. If you had tried to trade out of that at 4,800, you would have missed the run from 4,800 to 5,100. And we're sort of back to that overbought level again. Not as bad as we were in December, but we've remained very, very high. And that's why here we remain sort of neutral to our equity allocations in the benchmarks. We recognize some great things going on in the economy with AI and capital investments, et cetera. But we also recognize that valuations are reasonably high at this time. Why is that the case? Why is that happening? With interest rates coming, higher and higher and higher, having come higher and higher and higher, rather, with balance sheet runoff being destimulative, what's going on? The bottom line is, we believe we're in a secular bear market that's, just like the secular bear market of the 1990s was driven by the dot-com and the internet boom and build-out. This one is being driven by the boom and build-out of artificial intelligence, or AI. The size and the scope of this investment in productive infrastructure is massive. And it's early days. It will continue for years to come. And the companies that are delivering this are largely and almost exclusively centered in the United States. Companies like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, Applied Materials. Some of these, Microsoft and Applied Materials and Google, were all, part of the last big build out. But they seem to be the players. They're represented in, the Mag 7, but they're also represented in the S&P 500, significantly in the NASDAQ composite. And the earnings of these companies continue to surprise to the upside. The white line represents the share price. The green line represents the earnings. It's been said that even though the share prices have risen substantially, to a certain degree, the earnings have outpaced even the share price. And for this reason, innovation, capitalism doing what capitalism was designed to do, or what it naturally does, which is deliver, a better economic outcome for everyone. So that for this reason, despite massive numbers of interest rate hikes, despite Fed balance sheet running off, you still continue to see these things go higher. And then, of course, now the expectations for rate cuts are sort of waning from market expectations. And as they leave market expectations, we would have normally expected, other things being equal, for markets to correct. But they're not doing that. It's largely because of this excitement around artificial intelligence and the spending and the build-out that's happening. Another one of the reasons markets can't seem to go down is that the federal government just can't seem to do anything other than spend at increasingly larger deficits. We always reserve in the past, the economic history of the United States, we reserve deficits for times of war and times of recession. And now, in times of boom, we are running larger and larger deficits. This seems to be true across both of the political parties. Keep in mind, it's the Congress that decides the spending level. The president can veto budgets and things, but the president doesn't have the line item that's been talked about since the 1980s. But put it in perspective, and I want to thank my colleague Eric Johnston for bringing this data to my attention this morning. The U.S. government, through deficit spending, is contributing significantly to the inflationary pressures of the economy. These are the exact pressures that the Federal Open Market Committee, the Fed, the FOMC, are trying to combat in order to bring core PCE inflation, a number we're going to get this week, back down to their target level, which is 2.4% or 2%. The average monthly budget deficit is running $147 billion at a time where we're not in recession and we're not formally in a state of war where you would need to ramp up spending and production. Prior to COVID, the average monthly deficit was running $83 billion. Now, admittedly, our GDP is bigger. And this today, this sort of brings out the differences, the main core differences in the economic platforms of our two dominant political parties. And by the way, prior to, you know, 2014 to 17, we were running $45 billion. So we just keep running larger and larger average monthly deficits. But in the two parties today, it's a question of degree of deficits that are appropriate. We used to have parties where one felt that deficit spending was okay and one believed in balanced budgets. Even going back to the Depression, we went through the balanced budget argument that obviously led to further, you know, a worsening of the Depression back then. But today, I think on the left side, the Democratic side, there's a belief that because of our position as the world's reserve currency, we can perpetually run deficits, which perpetually increases the GDP and the wealth of our country, and that the accumulated debt that results from the deficits is not threatening or consequential. On the right side, or the Republican side, I think there is a shift from the balanced budget mentality. There's very few people left in that party that believe, hey, you just kind of balance it out and save the recession or the deficit spending for recession or war. But they believe in smaller deficits. They think that the potential damage of the accumulated debt is significant and it represents a threat. But they still are willing to continue to deficit spend. So this is where we are. I do think this is a big risk that we have long term. Moving on, let's move on to expectations for interest rate cuts. They continue to decline. I have two boxes here. They look the same, but let me draw you to the differences. Here's the end of the year, December 29th, so the last trading day of last year. And I want to look at the March Fed meeting, March 20th. You can see there was basically an expectation that interest rates would be cut by 25 basis points in March. Then it would be 50, so another 25 by May, and then 75 and a full 100 by July. Fast forward to this morning, February 26th, the March meeting is next on the list. There is virtually no chance of a rate hike, no chance versus 100%. May is also virtually no chance versus 50. June, it's 50-50, you could get a cut, it looks like, versus 75 basis points. So this is a major change. And so if you have this major change, you would think you would have this run up in the equity markets, maybe reverse. But there is not a ceteris paribus. Things aren't always all things being equal. In this case, we have the secular bull market in place that's centered around artificial intelligence. Moving on, let's take a look at another part of de-stimulus. So the fiscal deficits are massively stimulative. The rate, keeping rates higher is destimulative, but it's being overridden by the budget deficits and overridden by the naturally occurring change from artificial intelligence. But the last one is the Fed balance sheet. The Fed balance sheet topped out at nearly $9 trillion. So this period from here, when COVID started, when we were at $4.5 trillion, to go to $9 trillion, was printing money, as we call it. We literally injected money into the system by buying up treasury bonds and mortgage bonds. That's what made those mortgage rates the lowest we may ever see again in our lifetimes. And that was very stimulative to the economy. Slowly letting the balance sheet run down and run off from $9 trillion to $7.5 trillion, it's almost $1.5 trillion in runoff. That is not enough to bring down inflation. We are shredding money or deprinting money because of the natural secular demand in the economy and the massive fiscal deficits continue to be run by the federal government. Okay, this week we've got new home sales, durable goods, house prices, both from FHFA and Case-Shiller. Consumer confidence remains high. Revision to the fourth quarter GDP report looks like nothing, 3.3%. Weekly claims, income, spending, the big one, the one that matters, PCE price index. This matters more than ever because the CPI and then some subcomponents of the CPI were horrible a week ago or 2 weeks ago now. And if this one tells a different story, the markets will be very happy. If it confirms what the CPI was saying, I don't think the markets will be very happy. So this is the most important data point of this week, January PCE price index. Then we've got Chicago PMI, pending home sales, the final readings on manufacturing and from both S&P Global and then ISM, which doesn't put out the flash, construction spending, consumer sentiment, and auto sales. So that's it for this week, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in. I appreciate it. Don't forget it's available both with subscription. Just email us info at efficient-portfolios.com or just talk to your smartphone and tell them to play Herb Morgan's podcast. The name of the podcast is Slaying Bulls and Bears. We make the complex and complicated simple and sensical. Thanks. Talk to you next week.